Okay, this is continuing with Fred Whipple on 13 August 79. So you were saying that back in the 20s you had...
I got into the receivers and built the self-regenerative sets and so forth and even sold some of them. But I never followed up very seriously. I never became a ham operator or anything. And so my knowledge of radio and later radar was that of an outsider. I was completely aware of the potentialities and the basic physics of it. But I never got involved in the details of the theoretical aspects of it.
Right, now you told me that you worked at the Harvard radar countermeasures laboratory. What was
yes, that was during the war with NDRC and OSRD. It was, it was called the Radio Research Laboratory, which was a deceptive name to cover the fact that it was a radar countermeasures laboratory and radio countermeasures. And being an astronomer and not an expert in electronics, I was put on to the so-called chaff program in this country, which was called window in England, of the confusion reflectors you could drop out of aircraft to follow up the German radar. And I followed that through from the inception of the concepts to the production, first in the laboratory and then by the industrial people of cutting the foil. In fact, I still have the original foil cutter that we used. I can show it to you. The idea of that was that we wanted to make L beams out of thin foil. It was 35 ten-thousandths foil on paper, you know. I think it was, And the idea was to make L beams. Well, the length was very convenient, about 10 inches, which is the 500 megahertz German radar, the Wurzburg. And so the technique we developed, and although I didn't invent it myself, it was done under my direction, I would have the next day if the guy hadn't gotten the idea while he was making the machine. You essentially take a lawnmower type of thing with a very small spiral angle instead of the big one that the ordinary lawnmower has, and you take it foil, the width of which is equal to the length of the strips,
which
is about 0.45 of the wavelength, and then you have alternately dull and sharp blades. So as the foil goes through, the dull blade bends it over, makes the L, and the sharp blade cuts it off, and you've got a right angle cross section. And that way we could use an ounce of that foil during the war to give an equivalent Wurzburg echo of a B-17 or B-24 with an ounce at the right frequency.
Right.
And we had to put in three lengths, I think we did, because they varied their frequency and there was quite a bit of spy work going on. Undercover work as to what frequencies they had and what frequencies we were jamming.
Right.
And so we had to cover the waterfront with three strips.
You mentioned that you actually collaborated with Hay.
Oh, yes. In England. When I was in England, I was there a number of months and must have been the winter of 43-44. Because I came home after the V1s. Had been well started. I had a lot of experience watching the V1s around London, and just before the V2s came in. And so I worked with him, and he was in radar and I think countermeasures for the Royal Air Force.
He's sort of an all-around troubleshooter, I think.
I think so. Yeah. He's a very capable guy.
Now, did he mention at all, first of all, the solar noise?
Yes, he did. He and I were in contact, and I heard about that, and then about the use of radar on meteors, which he got into shortly afterwards. So I was in contact with him, not very close, but enough to know what was going
on.
But
when you heard about meteors, your ears must have perked up.
Yes, it did. And so at that time, Jack Pierce here at Harvard was working on radar at, I think it was, a very low frequency. I can't remember the exact frequency. And I tried to interest him in doing radar media work at that time. But he was interested in the use of radar for Loran position finding and ships and so forth, and never did get interested. But in the Jacobini Zinner shower in the, was that in?
46, I believe.
It was in 46. Was it November?
Yeah, that's right.
November 46. He set up at the Agassiz Station of Harvard, and I was out there observing with him the echoes from that shower, in which at this low frequency actually gave an ionosphere in from meteors. It was the only time, first time at least, that was ever recorded, an actual ionosphere at the E-level region from meteors. Just over 100 kilometers altitude.
Do you know if you ever published that work?
I think so. I think I may have mentioned it in publications, but it never, it was just a count, and he never went any farther with it, much as I tried to get him into it. He went out to New Mexico later on, and was operating not far from where we were in the meteor project that I got going with ONR, when the Office of Naval Research supported our Supersmith media program, but I never could get any real interest on this part.
Did you try at all to get a program going in the observatory after the war? Or?
Not until after Jodrell Bank got into it. I was close to now Sir Bernard Lovell and with the other people working there, and because of that I got interested. That was about 1954, I think. Had a big conference over there on
oh, that's right. I know that conference, right.
Yeah. And they were getting a lot of nice results. So I wanted to see it continue at lower frequencies, because they were using these big antennas. Well, I've got an exact frequency thing, but I wanted to get it set up in this country, and got Hawkins, Gerald S. Hawkins, to come over, and we got the radio media project going.
He had gotten his degree at Jodrell.
We did that too much on a shoestring. We didn't spend enough money on it, and as a result, it never functioned as well as I would have liked. And we did rebuild it in the 60s, but it never did bring as many results as I would hope it would.
Well, can we go through this in some more detail now? When did it begin, and what facilities did you have, and so forth?
You mean at the
media radar?
The Harvard radio. Well, we had the station set up in southern Illinois, and I've forgotten the details of it now because it's a long time ago, and I have given away my personal records, letters and correspondence and all that to the archives at Smithsonian, so you could find it all.
Yeah.
All in the archives of Smithsonian, but I don't have the material at hand now, and my memory is weak on the details of it.
Well, I found a couple of reports in the library last night, actually, that that outlined the system and so forth.
Well, I do have some of those reports. I just ran into them the other day.
Yeah.
Do you want to shut this off while we take
a look at it? Well, that's okay. I can look at them for specific details. What I was getting at was...
let's see. I laid those out especially.
Well, maybe let me start off asking this way. What was the new information that you felt the radar technique was giving, and what was the information that you wanted to get out of the American system?
Well, I wanted to get fader media, so we put much larger antennas up with a much greater effective gain, so that you got fader media, because I wanted to get down at the lower end of the media. We call it meteoroid size range that you could reach with larger antennas than they used at Jodrell Bank. They had rather short, small, stubby antennas without very high gain, and we put in a very much better system.
And what astronomical information did you think of these smaller...
Well, I wanted to get to the smaller bodies in the interplanetary medium. You see, by that time, it had become pretty clear that these meteors that we're observing in the visual range and the larger radio meteors were indeed cometary debris, somewhat like the 90 to 95% higher level, And it was interesting to see whether by going fader we might pick up other components. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, that hasn't happened present until we've gotten down to the really microscopic particles. And there is some evidence of interstellar. I was hoping we might pick up interstellar stuff. In fact, my meteor project, starting back in 1933, when I became interested in it with Ernst Epic, was to follow up on his idea that we had interstellar meteors, that all stars, or most stars, had a great collection of his concept of what has become known as the Oort cloud. But that was a concept of his back in 1931 or 1932, would contain meteors, and as the sun passed through these large clouds, like, for example, star Sirius, we would pick up these in 1933. I calculated the radiance of all the meteors we might get from Sirius, but there was no evidence for them in any observational material, including the photographic and the radar and later on. But
so basically, you wanted to extend to fainter meteors to look at smaller particles.
And also, there was the question of the lifetime of the particles. What happened to them? If you have larger particles coming out of comets, they have collisions. The destructive influence is primarily collisions.
Mm-hmm.
The larger particles, there is some etching due to the solar wind, but fundamentally, the losses come from collisions. And the question was, what was the effect on the orbits of these smaller bodies compared to the larger bodies?
I see.
And also for cometary meteor streams.
Now, at that time, what did you see as the real value of the radar meteor technique? What was it?
It enabled you to study the motions of the fainter bodies. And it was not particularly more sensitive to velocity than the photographic. Both of them are very velocity sensitive, in that they are much more effective on the high velocity bodies than the low velocities. So the radar wasn't particularly worse. Radio meteor is not particularly worse in that respect. And it would then enable one to go to smaller bodies, see what their orbits were. I was interested in their orbits.
From an operational point of view, were there advantages to the photographic versus the radar technique, or is there equal?
No, they both could work if you set up a proper system.
Mm-hmm.
We had then the SuperSmit meteor cameras going in the early 50s, and I wanted to supplement this with the fainter radar meteors you get. We did, to some extent, carry on there. But it was never as successful as it might have been, because I think we were underfunded the program, didn't we?
What would you have liked to have had?
It was a question of the quality of the equipment more than anything else.
You mean automatic recording or stability of receivers, this kind of thing?
Yeah, stability of receivers and better components and so forth. Used a lot of surplus equipment. Perhaps wasn't the best for it, because we could save money that way. So I think the main error in that was not spending enough money on, also on design, high-level design and so forth,
mm-hmm.
and construction, which would probably cost three times as much as we spent.
Now, there was a controversy at that time, in the early 50s, about the origin of the meteors, which Erpic was involved in quite a bit.
Yes, well, as I said, that started back in the early 30s. With his idea that we were seeing a good fraction of the meteors that really belonged to other stellar systems or to the interstellar medium.
Right.
And it was very unhappy, my relationship with him, because in the late 40s it became quite clear to me from the photographic data that if such meteors existed, there weren't very many. And so I wrote papers showing that my disbelief in the idea, although I started out believing it, wanting to prove it. And Epic was very unhappy with that, and it was along in the early 60s before he really completely forgave me for not defending his idea, yeah. but it hasn't been supported. I was absolutely right, I think.
Now, I've heard it said that the radar meteor results were critical in that determination. Would you agree with that, or do you think
they were rather critical, but their uncertainties, you see, were serious enough. The real point revolved around the fact that the people who were defending the hyperbolic meteors and Epic's theory were always doing it at the high velocity tail end of the distribution curve.
Right.
The 72, 75 kilometer per second spillover due to observational errors in the technique. Now, I maintained, you see, that if there were hyperbolic meteors, you should see them at all velocity ranges because they'd catch up from behind. And of course, there was a heavy weighting factor towards the fast meteors because the radio, also the photographic, are much more sensitive to high velocity meteors. But I maintain that you ought to see the evidence for this in the, say, the 40 kilometer per second
mm-hmm.
range, not the 72 kilometer per second range. As a consequence, I disbelieved and argued against the proponents of the hyperbolic meteors concept when they defended on the basis of this spillover at 70. Over 72 kilometers per second, the head-on velocity.
Now, and you're saying the spillover was really just due to errors at the edge of the distribution.
No, because the radio technique in those days, and I suspect it's still pretty much true, is much larger scatter than the photographic. You get really high accuracy in the photographic, and there were all sorts of uncertainties. There was still, I haven't followed the subject in recent years, but there was still the uncertainty as to the development of the ion cloud
mm-hmm.
around the body, whether that was throwing in some areas too.
Right.
So you had a large scatter in the measurements, and that scatter then spilled over above the hyperbolic limit and was interpreted by quite a few people in those early days as to prove the existence of hyperbolic meteors, and that was what I was arguing. So it's unhappy with that.
So it seems like what you're saying is that there was both radio and optical data that
spilled over
pinned this down finally.
Yeah, well, optical was the most conclusive because of the precision and because it's not quite so sensitive to velocity as the radio radar.
So you thought the optical was somewhat more conclusive, okay.
The accuracy was higher.
Let me ask a general.
The numbers were not so abundant. The accuracy is much higher. Yeah.
Let me ask a general question. As you look at the development of meteor astronomy through the early 1960s, anyway, what do you think has been the key thing that the radio has added?
It's adding the fainter meteors.
So bigger numbers.
Much bigger numbers, the smaller bodies. That's the important thing. Right?
And has this led
to... And, of course, the other extremely important thing was the fact they could operate 24 hours a day.
Right, the daytime showers.
The daytime showers, which we had to miss photographically. Of course, the one that I was most pleased with, and that happened just after the war, was the Tauride meteors and the Encke's Comet, you see, because I had predicted that... from the observation of the photographic meteors, these tides were coming in both angling up and down with respect to the orbit of the Earth, which meant that there was a large scatter in the inclinations of those orbits
mm-hmm.
due to the nodes being shifted around. And I predicted that there should be daylight meteors from that stream around the end of June. And They found them, you see, as radar meteors. So that was a nice accomplishment. Now, the thing that I goofed on, and Kresak over in Czechoslovakia just recently picked it up, was that I should have realized that the Tunguska fall, which occurred at the right time and the radiant not very well determined, but more or less in the right direction, was probably a piece of Encke's Common. I didn't pick that up, and he did.
That's interesting. So that fell in June? I see.
Late June.
Yeah.
In
1908,
yeah.
Now, it seems to me that meteor radar astronomy, anyway, tailed off around the world in the late 50s and early 60s.
I don't know how much is being done today.
Very little is going on now.
It's the same as with optical, except for the bright fireball collection of meteorites, for the simple reason that you've got this distribution function of velocities and sizes, and then the hard work, which is still going on, and I think has a long ways to go, is to get a really good theory for the ablation and brightness ionization produced by a body at 10 to 72 kilometers per second in the atmosphere. Now that theory is being vastly improved recently. I see these papers from time to time. I haven't followed in detail, but that is what you need. Now I presume that there will come a time when somebody will want to spend the money to go down to extremely faint bodies, but you see, the space people are now doing it.
Right.
And they're getting these tiny ones and going down to the
just put plates
10 to the minus 14 grams and so forth, outside the reach. So that is a better way of doing it, although they have difficulties yet in getting very good velocities and orbits. But
so is what you're saying then that basically the data had been gathered and there really wasn't much to do on that score,
right.
And the theory had to catch up.
You know the amount of ionization. The question is, what is the size of the body and what's the drag on it? And the theory, far below and behind. See, the radar people simply took over the theory that I'd adopted for photographic meteors, and they called it something new, but it was just an exact copy of mine, adjusted for the properties of ions instead of light. And that was a pretty crude theory, and I never had much defense for it. I mean, it was useful at the time, but you need a very much better theory for it than I had.
So what you're really saying is that the fall off in the amount of work going on in meteor radar astronomy around 1960 in that era was also happening in optical work on meteors.
So the only very big programs that are going on now are the three programs on the bright fireballs.
And
Canada and the USS. And
but even in the 60s, there was not that much going on in meteors?
Began to die out in the 60s,
Yeah, that's interesting. Well, let me ask you another more general question about radio astronomy now. In general, you've been in astronomy for a long time now.
That's for sure.
What would you see as the main contributions or the main influence that radio astronomy has had on the field?
Oh, well, if you take astronomy generally, it's colossal. I mean, the identification of the interstellar clouds and all these different complicated molecules. And comets, of course, we've only seen three of these new molecules,
right.
Hydrogen cyanide and methyl cyanide and sulfur dioxide, is it? And but nevertheless, in that and in the, of course, the study of quasars, radio stars, I mean, it's been a phenomenal contribution to science of astronomy.
Do you see any contribution not so much to the astronomical knowledge, but to the way of doing astronomy?
It's quite clear that that you're going to understand a lot more about bodies if you can use the entire electromagnetic spectrum. And now they've gone, of course, to gamma rays on the one hand and to the long radio waves on the other. And the interesting thing is that the black hole, quote-unquote, type phenomenon, the highly condensed, high gravitational field bodies, shows up, you see, both in the radio and in the
gamma rays.
And the gamma rays and X-rays.
Right.
Which gives you a colossal measure of it, and oftentimes much stronger there than you have in the optical. So that's an enormous contribution. It's just one of the integral parts of modern astronomy, and we would be very much worse off without it.
What about the style of doing things in terms of
and also
how one goes setting up?
Not to mention radar of the surface of Venus. How are you going to get the map of Venus, a topographical map of Venus, except by radar?
Right.
You're not going to send any machines down there to 730 degrees.
100 atmospheres.
100 atmospheres.
What about in the style of doing experiments? Do you think radio astronomers, of course originally they were electrical engineers, have influenced the traditional astronomers in any way?
Of course, but everyone does his own thing, you see, and if you're trained in that area, you go ahead and work in it, and if you're not, you find it very difficult to switch over to that sort of a field. So that there are, what it has done, not only the radio astronomy, but the X-rays and the gamma rays, have brought into astronomy much brighter minds than the youngsters. We're now, the best theoretical minds in the old days always went into theoretical physics. Well, now the theoretical physics has gotten so narrowed that we're getting in astronomy a lot of those brilliant theoretical minds that would have erstwhile in old days gone into physics. And so that I would say that the scientific or intellectual level of the astronomer is much higher today than it was when I was young.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
And do you see that as a sort of a continuous process that's happened, or do you see
some... Yes, it's a continuous process, yes. As physics began to narrow itself down to the high-energy accelerators, you see, and the solid-state physics, which are the two big areas today, well, there just there's not enough room with high-energy accelerators for all the bright young minds that would like to do something in theoretical physics, so they go into astronomy. We're getting them in modern astronomy. And the space program, of course, is an enormous opportunity for training and for jobs.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Well, you're quite welcome.
Okay, that finishes talking with Fred Whipple on 13 August 79.